Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. The bad news is I have a bit of a cold. The far better news, we have an in-studio guest this week. Rowan Phillips, welcome. And we're going to talk about your book. Jamie Lasanti is here. We're talking about the Portland Trail Blazers, but we're going to pivot to tennis. You've written a book that came out, what, about 2 months ago now, right?
Yeah, November last year.
It's called The Circuit, and it's a terrific read about 2017 in pretty much men's tennis. I mean, there's some references to the women's game, but...
Yeah, where the tournaments meet up, Indian Wells, for instance, Miami. But it was proved to be too difficult to put the two together. They're almost like a double helix where they separate and come together once in a while. So I focused on the ATP tour.
So the biggest you do these book readings and you do this publicity junket, and the most trite question you always get is, why did you want to write this book? Which I always feel like is the knee jerk first question when you're doing AM radio in Mishawaka. But I also feel like there actually is some real insight in that question. I mean, we know the who, we know the when, but start us off. I mean, you could have written anything. You're a poet. You're an academic. You've written about a wide variety of topics. How did you end up in this crazy corner of the world?
Well, you know, I hurt myself. In 2016, I was playing a charity basketball game for the National Book Foundation, tore my Achilles tendon. It was right around Wimbledon, which I was going to watch anyway. But with the way that things happened in Wimbledon 2016, Federer literally falling on his face and then kind of choking away a match against Raonic, Serena losing to Kerber in that final, and then basically things working themselves out so that Murray went on this incredible run through the end of the year to become number one, found myself thinking that the start of 2017 was going to be really, really, really interesting to think about. I had no idea what was going to happen. As far as we knew, Federer, who had knee surgery, and was now ranked 17th,
right, exactly,
was going to come into the Australian Open, the 17th seed.
This might be his last. Prepare your farewell pieces.
That's right.
Because this might be his last major.
Rafa lost convincingly to Luca Pui at the U.S. Open, and then needed to rest and recover. And so at the start of 2017, he was ranked 9th. Another minefield seed to go through a major in. Murray finally was at the top of the game. It looked like, you know, it was going to be Murray versus Djokovic with Milos Raonic and Stan looking to kind of maybe out of nowhere finish his set of majors. And I just thought, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm going to watch the matches anyway because I always watch the matches. I love tennis. I've always loved tennis. And I wanted to start to think about what happens when you start in January and take yourself all the way through? Because tennis is maybe the only sport I can really think of that starts January 1st, and then it takes you through the year. It's literally a year.
Right.
And what a weird year 2017 was going to be off the bat with everything going on off the court. And I was really curious about the rhyme, if I could put it that way, the rhyme between the world that we were kind of entering into in 2017 and this unknown world of tennis. Were we going to start a new tennis life without Roger and Rafa? Were we going to have to get used to Milos Raonic always being at the back end of tournaments? Was the big story going to be, can Stan win Wimbledon? And so I started to write. I write for the Paris Review. They're kind enough to let me write on sports when I feel like it. And I was writing about the Australian Open, and then I found myself writing about Indian Wells and writing about Miami, and it was just this swell of a story that I felt building up, and it was a launch into the unknown, but it was a lot of fun, and I kept going. And this book, The Circuit, A Tennis Odyssey, is what came out of it. It's a book I love. I'm really proud of it, and I'm glad that you think so well of it.
It's a terrific book, and I think that,
thank you.
First of all, you avoid a lot of the traps. This is not a year-in-the-life type of book. I mean, that's sort of the general conceit, but you do not do the typical sort of inside the season inside.
No.
I also want to go back to what you said before, because I think you captured so well in that Australian Open chapter there were world events that contrasted strikingly with the action at that 2017 Australian Open. I don't know if people remember. It was so strange. We were talking about this before. It was so strange being there that we had this regime change and we had Donald Trump's inauguration was the same weekend as the final. And for being there in person, I remember you're feel like you're a planet away. You've got Rafa, you've got Roger. No one expected to see them in this final, this resurgence. You had the Williams sisters. Similarly, I don't think anybody would have called that final, and tennis seemed to be at its most elevated. And I remember, you know, our social media feeds, which is how we usually track time these days, was half the virtue of tennis, Roger, Rafa, Venus, Serena, and then it was Muslim bans and American lawyers flooding airports, and this Trump presidency is taking root, and it's immediately starting off as a jarring experience. You really captured the strangeness of that weekend. And I wondered what it was like having that unfold from you. You were here when you wrote that. You were watching this play out in real time. You knew immediately that there was some real narrative thrust here. This was really sort of this could be an anchor for a chapter.
Yeah, you know, in part because of the feeling you get amongst people. You know, when you watch the Australian Open, when you start, you've been starved for some tennis because oh my goodness, it's been about 2 months without tennis. Imagine,
right?
The Australian Open is underway, and usually they're those diehards who are up at these strange hours if you're not there, and you're talking to tennis about them. But I found myself, John, finding people who normally didn't watch tennis also up at 4 in the morning, up at 5 in the morning, up at 3 in the morning, watching these matches, and not just the finals, but we're talking round of 32 and things like that. And it was clear to me that people were so unsettled, regardless of what side of the political spectrum they may have been on. It was so unsettled in the world, and tennis was becoming a type of therapy or partner through the darkness and through the sunrises to kind of make sense of the world. And it was a beautiful example, I think, of the way in which people can get through things with tennis, and the way in which also tennis, we like to think sometimes that it's played out in a bubble, but it's always like a Venn diagram touching the world. So we wanted to just celebrate the great surprise and tickle our nostalgia with a Roger and Rafa final, a Venus and Serena final, and that was there on the table. But at the same time,
such a great way of framing it. Exactly.
At the same time, you have the airport protests. The Roger Rafa final was the day of the airport protests, and for me, that was a spur for thinking about the way in which tennis is and is not part of the world. The way in which tennis can be there for fanatics, but also people who aren't usually watching every match. It's there for them. And the type of bleary-eyed commitment that people can make to it. And even at the end of that great, great tournament, which was not only great, I think, John, because of the quality of play, I think sometimes in the finals we lose sight of those great semifinals, Rafa and Dimitrov,
right.
Stan, coming back from two sets down and playing five sets against Roger. It was a great tournament. The court was fast and always so vibrant and beautiful, the Melbourne courts. And it was a real, for me, poignant kickoff to what seemed like a story with great legs. Kind of, what do we do now? What do we do in the world now? Right? People are getting detained who think that they have a green light, no pun intended, to enter a country, people being detained. And at the same time, the tennis panorama as we knew it froze. What do we do? Because before Australia, everything seemed to be running along fine, right? As we expected it to be. We had Doha with a final between Djokovic and Murray.
Right.
We have in Brisbane.
Which was supposed to be a precursor. This was the new rivalry, and this was going to take root.
In Brisbane, Dimitrov is kind of getting himself together. He's kind of dealing with the whole baby Fed thing. He wins that. He beats Nishikori. We have also Raonic and Stan in the semifinals of those. Okay, everything seems to be going the way we'd expect 2017 to go. And then 2017 just twists with the Australian Open and also with the political and social situation. And for me, it's there you go with the story, and that's what started the Odyssey for me.
No, I think that's such a smart—I mean, this capacity for surprise. We never thought we would see a president who was going to ban one religion from immigration and airport protests, and we never thought at some level that we were going to see another Rafa-Roger Grand Slam final. What was it like? I mean, again, we think about a season inside, and traditionally these books rest on a certain axis. They're very sort of anecdote-driven and cult of personality-driven. You really resisted that. I mean, you write beautifully, you write fluidly about the sport itself and the ball striking and the stroking and where this fits into a larger mosaic. This is not a book about inside the locker room anecdotes.
And there I was.
And gossip, And I looked over and Novak Djokovic kissed his wife and whispered in her ear. I mean, this is not you sort of, I think, admirably resisted that fly on the wall urge, which I think is what we usually think of when we hear these season inside books. What was it like, first of all, mediating a lot of this from getting us through TV? I mean, a lot of this you were watching from New York.
Yeah.
But also, did you have these sort of, I don't want to call them temptations, but were there any instincts to, I want to really delve into Andy Murray? I mean, you keep this remove throughout the book, which I think shows a lot of discipline. Did you have a temptation to turn this into gossip and character studies and anecdotes you were picking up through the tennis transom?
No, and I was picking some up, but I wanted to be faithful to what I was doing and what I wanted to do, which is really connect with spectators and think about this as a work of spectatorship, right? To think about, listen, all of you people who might read the Circuit of Tennis Odyssey, you watch a lot of these matches like I do from a distance, where you're kind of putting together how you feel and what you know about a player from that distance. We're always mediating this type of distance. And I wanted to find the sweet spot there. I'm fascinated by tennis fandom and the way in which it being when you play singles, it being kind of an individual sport, there's no helmet, there's no name on your back, but you just kind of see this person enduring whatever they're enduring, and you make sense of them, you love them, or you hate them from that. And I wanted to, I wanted that to be the key signature of the book, kind of like getting a sense of what it's really like to tell a story where what you have is a player playing, right? And that, as a reader and as somebody who watches tennis, this is kind of like vibing with that sensibility, what it's like to be a spectator. Also, access is a very kind of like leveraged chimera that I'd love to talk about.
You don't do leveraged writing.
No, I don't. And I don't, you know, I'm not interested in trafficking in a certain way of being on a beat. I want to tell a story using the best faculties that I have, and to think about tennis like somebody in a seat thinking about tennis. I mean, you know, I went to some tournaments like I always do, but I found myself thinking almost like a historian in the moment, if you will. And I think it worked out better that way.
I mean, I want to bring Jamie in because I don't know if people know that I am forever fascinated by Jamie's arrival, unlikely as it may be, in tennis. And I feel like it's something that should be, I mean, if I'm a tennis marketing type, I'm looking to replicate this. You have someone who's smart and tech savvy in their 20s and 5 years ago. Can I say this, Jamie?
Sure.
You know, not by any stretch a hardcore tennis fan. And she very quickly came to the sport and got it and has learned about the X's and O's, but also learns about the personalities. And you and I can talk about, you know, does Tomas Berdych have another run in him? And you're completely conversant. And you didn't grow up playing. You weren't someone who in high school was obsessing over this. You picked it up very quickly and didn't just pick up the facts, but really the vibe of tennis. What did you, I mean, you guys should both have at this, but what did you learn about the tennis fandom? And how is that different from what we were talking about before, about being a Portland Trail Blazers fan?
Well, I just want to say, listening to you describe that is basically how I wish I could describe it. I mean, you hit every nail on the head for me in terms of, I mean, John gets to go to all the tournaments. He's there. He's sitting down with these players just like we're sitting next to each other right now. And, you know, it's a different type of access. It's a different type of viewpoint. And I'm always the one who's getting up in the middle of the night or, you know, watching on TV. And I have one screen on my computer and one screen on my phone. I've got Twitter. I've got the TV broadcaster. So I really appreciate that viewpoint and kind of that outlook on the sport, because it's really, I've gone to, you know, I've been to the U.S. Open. I was fortunate to go to Wimbledon. I, you know, I've been to tournaments, but I think the majority of people who watch tennis and who are into the game don't get, you know, to be there. And everything you said about it being a singular sport that is so driven by personalities is also something that I told John the other day, that we should start a movie company that only creates tennis movies based on real life tennis, because it's so incredible. Like, you cannot make the stuff up that happens in this sport.
Everyone's got a story.
I've got some stories for you. Well, that's also part of the story too, though, like commitment, right? I mean, it's like, I'm somebody who gets up with my two daughters and watches the Shanghai Open at some ungodly hour. And that to me is part of the story sometimes about watching the Shanghai Open and having a six-year-old ask you, why is it dark? Right. You know what I mean?
You wrote about this, though. It's a great teaching device.
It is.
And you'll notice in Australia that it's time differences and it's geography and culture.
Or even in Brisbane, everything is named basically after Tennyson. You know, Tennyson and Idols of the King. So, you know, you start to think, oh, wait, everything that's kind of around the Brisbane Open is actually also connected to poetry. Who knew?
I did not know that. You also, I noticed, I mean, we talked about this last week, that it's very easy to, I find, to become cynical. I don't know, Jamie, I think you said this. It's tennis, sometimes it runs counter to a growth mindset. And you love the players, you love the athlete's soul, but it can become very frustrating to see how territorial and how self-defeating tennis can be. I don't know if you consciously resisted that or just didn't strike you. I mean, you did not let cynicism seep into this account.
Well, I'm going to shock and perhaps terrify both of you, but I am the rarest of breeds. I'm a born and bred New Yorker who's a devout optimist.
Oh, man. Dues paying and everything.
So I don't traffic. I don't traffic with kind of undigested cynicism. What's there to be cynical about? I work on and process, but I'm looking for how we are better, how we can be better, where tennis has the ability to make us think about what is possible and what is good, but without being naive about it. What's great about tennis is if you really lean forward and pay attention, you can see, and it teaches you the way in which influence plays itself out, and the way in which players even negotiate the problems in front of them. And some of them are right in front of them. This slice is giving me a hard time because I have to bend down all the time and hit my two-handed backhand, Sasha Zverev. Or they are interior, and you don't see them. My coach is really getting on my nerves. I wish they'd stop with all these hand signals. I don't need them.
Right. Yeah, you get rid of your coach.
Voila. But those things get worked out in the writing and thinking about the story. I find tennis to be an incredibly, at its best, an incredibly freeing sport and a sport of possibility. The geometry doesn't change. If you play Bournemouth and then you go and play Barca, you're going to be playing on two completely different fields. But with tennis, aside from the surface difference, which isn't much of a difference anymore, the geometries don't change. So you see people trying to enact a type of kinetic problem solving, but within the same space. And I find that to be beautiful and heartening and ennobling. And I find there to be great generosity in the possibility of the game. You could play it until you're 80 or 90. You could play it with your kids.
That really comes through. No, you really found virtue in this sport that really, really came through. But I'm wondering, you know, we have this expression, no cheering in the press box.
Uh-huh.
But we also have this expression, you root for the stories, right?
Right.
So there is, I think there's a lot of interest in Serena Williams, for example.
Sure.
I don't think necessarily it's because of fandom, but I think people recognize it's a great story. And if she were to tie Margaret Court and go on to set the all-time Grand Slam singles, that's a great story. So I think there's some partiality with story in the TV world. Candidly, there's an element of partiality with ratings when when Pliskova beat Serena, there were some long faces at ESPN because that had some commercial ramifications. Did you approach this agnostically, or were you found yourself, for the sake of your book, rooting for certain results?
I was just well.
If Milos Raonic wins a major in 2017, and you can't do the Rafa Roger resurgence theme, is that something that concerns you, or were you just going with whatever the results yielded? The results yielded.
Well, you know, we were talking well before we got on, John, about a book and a writer we both admire, John McPhee's Levels of the Game, and that has two main characters in it. One being the elegant and immortal Arthur Ashe, and the other being the...
How would you describe him? Chuck Ravner described his ex. What are your adjectives?
Well, as I put it in the book, but in the opposite way, the Milos Raonic of his time. You know, I would consider him to be...
Say, patrician pragmatist.
The straight guy in the story, I guess.
All right,
the mortal in the story.
That's a good way to put it.
But that's the story, and I'm always interested in the story. The expression, it is what it is, I live and die with that and try to figure out from there what this means, what it can mean. I would find if Milos Raonic won all the majors in 2017,
you would have figured out what to say.
Well, I would have figured out what to say because that's what we do. I'm a writer first and foremost, and the game is always ready to give us a great story. Always. I don't have favorites. I'm a completely non-hierarchical thinker. I don't have a favorite tennis player. I probably have great empathy for Stan Wawrinka and also for Kvitova.
Why?
Because they remind me of myself. I take big whacks of the ball, and some days I can hit with, I feel like anyone, and some days I just can't keep it in the court at all. And they seem to not be flummoxed by that. They understand themselves, which I think is really admirable. And what I lament in tennis is I think that you see a lot of players who haven't had an opportunity to really kind of like learn about themselves. Their parents are always hovering above them. Coaches who they're paying but kind of micromanage their lives are always hovering around them. I think what you've seen with the renaissance of Djokovic is somebody who's kind of figured himself, this self, out. I find that to be really heartening. And so it's not just that I see Stan or Petrin. I think, well, I actually kind of like, yeah, that reminds me of myself. But also just they seem like two people who, regardless of the result, they get themselves.
Right. I would add that's probably a benefit to, we talk about the aging of the field and all the 30-somethings. Know thyself. I mean, when your career peaks at 24 and you burst on the scene as an 18-year-old, that's a much different life cycle than Djokovic, who in his early 30s probably knows himself awfully well.
And knows Rafa pretty well at this point,
Oh,
too.
Right, and knows the rest of the field quite well. Also, you had no burning desire to, boy, I'm watching this guy. I feel like I really know him. I know his tendencies. I would really like to get to know him. I'd like to have a meal with David Goffin. Did you find yourself wanting to, I don't want to say break that fourth wall, but did you want to have a more intimate relationship with the people you're covering?
Yeah, when I started to really kind of settle into some of these characters in particular, I mean, Goffin is a real strong example and a good call. And part of the reason for that, John, is because this is not a book that's just about Roger and Rafa. It follows players, Dolgopolov, for instance, right? And where he starts in Brisbane and where he's ending up at the end of the year. But in writing about characters throughout the year and seeing them succeed and fail, and you find yourself thinking, what's going on?
But I feel like that's certainly, that would have been feasible. If you had said, boy, I'd really like to sit down and learn more about Taylor Fritz, that could have been arranged.
Well, while that could have been arranged, it I would have then had to kind of like reverse engineer some of the earlier work that I was doing. And I really the spur of the book was Australia. And that distance and kind of like creating communities because of that distance and the oddness of the situation was the key signature of the book. And I wanted to pay homage to that. Hopefully I'll write another book. I'm doing some digging now and some other things. Where that will be what's on the table. But for this, I think it's really important to pay homage to the mise-en-scene, right? To kind of like be in your key signature. And the key signature for this book was this type of relationship with the sport and with the athletes. Seeing Goffin, break himself really sadly and unfortunately and accidentally at the French Open.
Right.
I wanted to feel that melancholy from a distance. I didn't want to put a microphone in his face and ask him, "Oh, how you feeling?
Yeah, how do you feel?" Right.
Because, you know, we've both interviewed players. How are you feeling? Not too good.
That question seldom gets the answer. Right? I hope it does.
So, there's a lot of kind of discipline and I think kind of restraint. Also, it's kind of like a point conversation a little bit. And I wanted to stick with that.
You and I think you demonstrated this in 100 ways. You're with me on that. It's a great sport to write about, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's such a great sport to write about.
I mean, I feel like part of me wants to shout this from the rooftops, and part of me wants to keep this under my hat. I mean, you go through the checklist of what it is we like when we tell stories and craft narratives.
Oh yeah,
and you know, tension and shifting plots and.
I mean, Shakespeare wrote about it for a reason. Tolstoy played. You know, it's one of those things. It's the gift that keeps giving. I feel really fortunate that there have been so many great books on tennis before mine. I mean, yours, of course.
You mentioned the debt we both owe to John McPhee.
Sure. I mean, you know, but there's also this sense to me of... newsflash, it's 2019. There are so many reported articles, you know, investigative work done, and really, really fantastic stuff. My book is a complement or supplement to that as well.
And there's a timelessness, too. I mean, this book is not going to go... I'll tell you a funny digression. We were... thinking about writing about Naomi Osaka this week, I was going through, we did an interview with her coach during the Australian Open, and you're sort of looking at your notes, and then you realize one personnel move and the story that you have cooking in your head is now completely obsolete.
Yep.
This book will stand the test of time. This will not be sort of subject to the whims of results and personnel moves.
Well, from your lips, too. Whoever's ears,
Jamie's.
But that was the intention. But also, honestly, to contribute, it's such a great sport to write on, as you say. And there's been really great writing about it that's been made, and that continues and will continue to be made. And you know, my book is a small grain of sand in that shore. But I also love the way in which tennis gets us to think about place.
Right.
Gets us to think about gender, gets us to think about business.
Personhood. I mean, there's a lot of...
Well, and also even, you know, family and legacy and all this.
Right. Well, we were talking about democracy.
Yeah, that's right. Which I hope we'll continue to talk about, John.
Speaking of grains of sand, we will link an essay that the... I don't know if it was... Was that an excerpt or a standalone essay on clay court tennis?
That's
my grain of sand segue.
The thing about the birth of clay court tennis,
exactly.
That's an excerpt from the book. Yeah,
that's an excerpt. You know, I mean, I think the people, what did you learn about the sport? I'm more interested in you. But what did you learn about yourself with this project?
You know what? No one has asked me that. Well, you know, coming full circle in this conversation, I had... completely severed my Achilles tendon. It was the first big injury that I'd ever had in my life. And I was also writing this book as I was rehabbing, as I was getting better. What I learned about myself is that I love this game even more than I thought I did. this is the game. Oh, this book made me realize things. Like, this is the game that I would sit with my family and watch. We weren't a family. We're a close family in the way that, you know, a family's close. But we don't huddle around together and do stuff. John, we huddled around and watched tennis from the 70s on. You know, my folks are immigrants from Antigua, and they gave me tennis from a young age, and I had really forgotten about that. I'd forgotten my dad. You know, tennis was the conduit through which I really kind of like fostered a particular and enthusiastic relationship with my parents. I don't know why or how I'd forgotten about that. But I'm grateful for that, because it's kind of, in writing the book, I also came to realize and remember what a place the tennis had always had in my life. And that now, as a father of two young kids, that I'm not going to have them hitting forehands and backhands at 5 a.m. But I love to see them interact with the game and the personalities and who they seem to have an affinity for and why.
Right. There's character revelation and who you root for. Pass that gift on.
Yeah.
I wanted to add something on that. I read in January, I guess, you did a Q&A with Deadspin. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I noticed in the Q&A was when they asked you about how you were drawn to the game growing up, you did mention your father and family and how all of that played a role. But the one thing you did mention was that, you know, he called you one day and told you to turn on the TV because someone was on the TV reading, or I guess, reading a poem about
Jamie. An original poem.
Oh,
that's right.
And guess who that was? Oh, I thought Jamie. That was really cool.
And other than John L.
really have
worth on. It was a marvelous moment. And I'm so glad you bring that up, Jamie, because my father does not text me to tell me to do things, right? And my father doesn't really text me. But my father texted me and said, turn on the TV. And I knew there wasn't a match on. So I'm like, why is my father telling me to turn on the TV to the match? And there's John reading an original poem.
Yeah.
And that's actually the only time my father, and my folks have always been supportive of my writing, but that's the only time my father's ever said anything to me about poetry.
Oh,
ever.
Man.
Tennis, look at that.
You're making me.
We're gonna have to dig that up. Can we outro with John's poem?
Come on.
I'm gonna see if I can find it right
wait,
now.
Wait, I would just.
Do you remember that?
What vaguely, tournament was it?
Vaguely, it was Wimbledon.
It was Wimbledon.
How cool is Tennis Channel for allowing? Someone to do tennis poetry on the air.
Oh yeah, you know your father sends you a text saying, "Turn on the turn on Tennis Channel." I'm thinking, well, I usually have Tennis Channel on, but I don't have it on right now. There's not a match on, and then there's John reading a poem.
All right, you're making me.
And I love that. But yeah, that's what I got out of the book. All of these ways in which tennis wasn't a contact high for me because I wrote this book. It wasn't John, well, this seems interesting, let me write about it. But it was kind of almost like that Madeleine that Proust bit into.
Yeah, right, Proustian,
and sent me back to who I was and had been, but also forward into who I hope I can be. I love this game. I play it at least once a week. Sometimes I'm fortunate enough to play it more often than that. But it's... it's here, it's in me, and I feel like I have more stories to tell in different registers, different key signatures, and I'm here for that.
I'm so heartened to hear that. We want you to stay in this in this ecosystem, like I said. It's fine. I mean, I think the statute of limitations has probably lapsed. John Feinstein wrote a book on tennis, I think in the early 90s, and it was more conventional, season inside and behind the curtain and what I witnessed. And apparently he said, I did a golf book, and all I wanted to do was when was my next golf book, and I did a tennis book. I spent a year in tennis, and I said, God damn it, I never want to go to another tennis match again. You did not emerge with that sensibility.
No.
Your passion for tennis only intensified after this.
No, absolutely. Yeah. It's because I also, what I had never actually done was think about it as a year. I never kind of like, you know, you watch the matches, but I hadn't thought about kind of being encapsulated in a year. But a year is how we all define ourselves, right?
Sure.
I am X years old. This year I'm going to do this. We make resolutions and everything like that. And
you were okay with that. You didn't find that artificial. You were okay with that.
Well, it's not artificial because it's just that we don't tend to think about tennis. Tennis is the one major sport we don't tend to think about in terms of seasons. We think in terms of tournaments and majors, right, and everything, but we know which players had certain great seasons, but I'm just thinking, because
we have these years, and Djokovic and Murray receded in 2017, but look at where Djokovic is now, and you sort of say, well, what's January to December really mean if we're laying this out as sort of a Mobius strip of his career?
Well, yeah.
So I wanted to, I was going to say, usually Jamie and I sort of catch up on news and notes after our half hour, which we've hit. But I want to keep you in for this because I do think potentially there's some transition here, potentially not. Mm-hmm.
Happy to.
Jamie, you jump in here too. But big story this week, obviously, was Naomi Osaka parting ways with her coach, Sasha Bain. Given what you observed about the tennis player and the tennis player's heart and soul writing this book, does that at all shade this news item that seems to have taken a lot of people by surprise? Yeah, do you have insight not on the specifics of this breakup, but on the insight of what would have caused a move like that? That seems counterintuitive to the casual fan, having looked so closely at this breed of cat we call tennis player.
Well, yeah, you know, in writing the book is structured, even though it's a year, it's structured in terms of quartet,
right?
The four seasons. Winter, spring, summer, fall, which are the four seasons. But so it also gives a player constantly an ability to reset, right? You reset after the Australian Open, you reset after the Sunshine Double, you reset when the surfaces change, but you also reset point to point. And I think that it's more natural than the common or casual fan might think for a player, if they're not burdened by being told what to think about resetting, to restart, because they're constantly the most kind of like exaggerated version of it is Sharapova turning her back and looking at her strings. Right. But I take that all as kind of a physical metaphor for this idea of kind of like, all right, let me clear my head. Let me take inventory of what's going on and what am I going to do next. And I think that when you see Naomi Osaka.
It's control, alt, delete.
And I think that players, particularly at that level, you can't not split step. Right, you can see club players not do that, but the pros, and the better you are, the more that you do it. There's some matches, particularly with Federer and Djokovic, where I just watch their feet, because that's where the story is. And I think that with Naomi, you put it so well in the mailbag. This is not really surprising if you kind of step back and look at the panorama and what happens. But my thought is just that I'm not surprised to see a player. After they've had, see, the second major I think is fascinating because it is consolidation, right?
Right.
And so the, oh my gosh, I can't believe this happened is over. And with Naomi, especially with the first major and everything that happened.
I was going to say, this has a whole other layer to add to that.
Yeah. Which actually, I'm having so much fun in this conversation. It's making me wonder if Naomi won cleanly without all the pyrotechnics at the U.S. Open last year, would she have
the experience? Yep.
Yeah, but great also question. Would she have made that change then?
Oh, made the that's interesting.
You know,
right?
But I'm not surprised at all when a tennis player kind of all deletes.
I'll add something too, and Jamie, I want you to jump in here as well, because I think, first of all, casual sports fans, I don't understand. It's like the Patriots firing Belichick. You're riding high. This is not a conventional coach team type of dynamic.
Not at all.
Part of it is financial. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's the player that's paying. Part of it is it's an individual sport. And I think we also forget just the personality of this. This is in no way to condemn, but I was going to DM Sasha and sort of see if there was anything he wanted to add. And I look at his Twitter profile and he's topless, and God bless him. We make no judgments. We all have our own aesthetics, but I'm also thinking about Naomi Osaka and sort of what I've come to know about her and spending a bit of time around her and what she's trying to project and their culture and sponsors. And I'm thinking that's sort of a strange combination. And I wonder if picture of a guy topless on his Twitter bio doesn't actually give us some insight that you forget that there is really a personality matchup that's got to exist here. And some of this is about imparting wisdom, and she's kicking her serve out wide when she's serving to the deuce court. And some of this is just about a normal relationship. And if values and sensibilities and priorities are not aligned, it's very easy to see how that player-coach relationship could go sideways. Do I think she fired him because I think this relationship doesn't exist anymore because of a topless photo? No, but it did. I did see that image, and it got me thinking that a lot goes into this relationship, and a lot has to be right for this relationship to be right. I mean, I don't, Jamie, jump in here. When you, when that tweet from Naomi Osaka sort of came up on your feed, what was your response?
Tennis, such a cold sport. It really is. No, it's surprising and not surprising. I think, as you said, for people outside of tennis, they look at this and they go, oh my gosh, we make a huge deal. We call it, you know, we have a whole day in the NFL where all the coaches get fired, and we really like
Black Monday.
Talk right about on. All of this stuff. You know, people lose their jobs in sports often, and it's really a huge storyline. And this was in the same way a huge storyline, but for very different reasons. I am with you on the relationship aspect of it. I think that's what makes the coach-player relationship in tennis in particular very unique, because you know, nowhere else is your coach traveling with you and only you. You know, you know, Steve Kerr is traveling with the Warriors, but he's got his own family right. And his own thing.
Well, and the owners are paying Steve Kerr and not Steph Curry.
Right. But in this relationship, it is one-on-one. It's the one person that you're turning to for, you know, tactics, but also training. And, you know, you're probably eating dinner when you land and wherever you're landing. And so there's right. A lot more to the relationship there that I think is to your point that, you know, it's very, very different than what we think of the coaching relationship.
I think keep in mind, too, I think some of this, too, is about tennis especially and everything that is freighted on a player. People said she did so well under him.
Under him.
And I wonder if she isn't saying under him.
Yep. Right.
That's my ass out there hitting that serve.
It's a completely different definition of what a coach is.
Right.
And the other thing, too, I think what people, and this was something coming into tennis that I had to really understand, is the coach, the hitting partner, all of these different people that are on your quote-unquote team that are very integral, because at the end of the day, you can't play tennis with yourself, really. You know, you have to have someone there to... Players practice with other players before tournaments. I mean, there's so many things about tennis in terms of practice and preparation that are so different from other sports that I think really play into the dynamic of something like this happening.
I also wonder, because a major has just ended and we don't have another one, obviously, until we get to Roland Garros, there's also this thing, because we're talking about a WTA player and the coach, and the coach at all the non-majors having the ability, if I'm doing air quotes, forgive me, listeners.
Yeah.
If the player so requests it, the coach then will come down to give counsel and everything like that. And could Naomi have been thinking, I don't want to be in Indian Wells or Miami or in Rome and
right.
Be in a bad rut and have my coach suggesting to come down. I want to see if I can kind of figure this stuff out myself. What was that quote that you gave us back that Naomi said about the message that, what did Sasha tell you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
She said, I didn't talk to him, basically.
Right.
That's what she said.
Right.
So maybe also, you know, between the majors, Naomi is like Petra and like Stan a little bit, she will have those tournaments
right.
where it's just kind of like, you know,
it's not
fine-tuned.
Right. Well, it's like we have people coaches who come on as pure, we're just gonna have a relationship for this tournament. You know, Djokovic has Agassi sitting on his bench, you know? There's things like that
right.
happen in tennis that is like,
well, let me
it's crazy.
I'm staring at Roland's book, and I'm thinking, imagine if your editor had his own Twitter account, and you're thinking like, that's my ass that's writing that book. I'm the one missing my kids' t-ball games, and I'm the one that's staying up. And your coach is holding press conferences, and here's what I told Rowan, and Rowan is a good learner, and under my tutelage, Rowan has really upped his game. And on the one hand, you're thankful for your editor. Your editor no doubt improved your copy. It's an intense relationship. But I wonder if there also isn't, whoa. Like, I'm the one who's, you know, bleeding ink here, and you're holding your own press conference. You've got your own Twitter feed because of my book.
Well, and you're paying for that. It would be also, I'm paying my editor.
Right.
But on the flip side.
Which I'm not, by the way.
Are you gonna write the book without your editor? You know, are you just gonna ban all editors for the so?
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, I think that's a real. Actually, we can keep going with this analogy. That's a really good point too. I mean, I don't know if I mean you saw Halep. I might try to go this alone. And by the end of the Australian Open, she was already talking to other coaches. So I think it'll be really interesting to see what Naomi Osaka does next. I think she is sort of a fascinating character anyway.
Oh, so fascinating.
What fascinates you?
Well, I'll tell you what. The 2016 US Open match against Maddie Keys. Mm-hmm. I think about that all the time when I think about Naomi Osaka. All the time.
Because the narrative, she lost in a set breaker.
She lost a match that she had in the third set.
Right. Yeah.
It was easier to win than to lose. And the narrative, of course, you know, Maddie Keys was and still is one of the.
Yeah, it's an incredible split, that narrative. Right. Thinking
But that moment. Well, this is why these are the things that spur me to write. Though I didn't write on that. I was very, very much starting my recovery from the Achilles tear. But the narrative at that point was Maddie Keys was destined to win multiple slams. She was the next big thing. Naomi Osaka was somebody who is this.
Real wild child was sort of the rap. She could hit the hell out of the ball, but still hadn't quite figured out how to win.
But also there was the sense that, well, she did win, but think about how much money she got, which is going to, for getting this far, which is going to kind of really consolidate her opportunity to kind of like, you know, be around in some tournaments and get the coaching and training and da-da-da-da. And that changed. Took a while, but you know, the narrative has turned itself not only on its head, but I wonder how much Naomi thinks back to that moment as well. I'm fascinated by thinking about what players hearken back to when it's time to think about moving forward.
Right. And I always find that they're very reluctant to talk about this, and it's a lot about short-term memory loss and flushing the bad losses. And then you talk to them later on in their careers, certainly after their careers, and they remember these inflection points, and they have vivid memories of this match on a Tuesday in Cincinnati sent me in a tailspin, and they're very reluctant to discuss them in the present. But when they take inventory of their career, there's no doubt that 10 years from now, Naomi Osaka will be giving chapter and verse on that Madison Keys match. Mm. This was great. This was I just want to say how heartening it is to see someone spend time in tennis and have it not deplete their passion at all. Quite the opposite.
I'm in it to win.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's a terrific book. It's a different book.
Thank you.
It's poetic. Again, I mean, I think this year inside in sports. We talked about Breaks of the Game, the great David Halverson book from the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
This has become a whole genre. Technically, this is a year in a sport, but this is not, this is a unique book.
Thanks. Yeah, I love it.
And I mean that in the, I mean that in the most flattering way.
I love being here. John, Jamie, thanks so much. Thanks to Frost Grouse Drew for publishing The Circuit of Tennis Odyssey.
Now that we've disparaged this sort of abstract editor.
I'm actually honored. It's the same publisher publisher's Levels of the Game.
We use this editor as a hypothetical. Why don't you give your editor a shout out?
Jonathan Galassi, president and publisher of FSG. He's okay. He got it.
Go check his Twitter account right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Jonathan Galassi on Twitter would be funny.
Is he showing his abs?
I'm really thrilled that we had this conversation, and really thrilled that you think so highly of the book. I obviously think highly of all the work you've done, and hopefully we can collaborate some in the future.
I would love that. And we'll rope Jamie in too, because Jamie's terrific.
Thanks Amen. So much. I can't wait to read it. Thanks, Jamie. I'm really excited.
All right. That does it for this week. That was great fun. Really enjoyed that. Thanks, Rowan. Thanks, Jamie. We will link to The Circuit on our page. We will... You like an Amazon link? don't know how we about we'll do a Powell's book link as well for the good
PDX,
folks in
City
in the 503 area code.
Love you, Portland.
We will. We may well have another in studio guest next week. But I'm glad we did this. This was good fun, and I hope people enjoyed that. Thanks for listening, everyone. Keep the guest suggestions coming. Subscribe, write a review, compliment us on our outstanding audio quality this week.
Feel better, John.
No, we're fine. Thanks, everyone. See you next week. We'll be right back.